Chapter 12. But it appears that he had juggled with accounts, cooked balance sheets, had gathered in deposits months after he ought to have known himself to be hopelessly insolvent, and done enough of other things, highly reprehensible in the eyes of the law, to earn for himself 7 years penal servitude. The sentence making its way outside met with a good reception. A small mob composed mainly of people who themselves did not look particularly clever and scrupulous, leavened by a slight sprinkling of genuine pickpockets, amused itself by cheering in the most penetrating, abominable cold drizzle that I remember. I happened to be passing there on my way from the East End, where I had spent my day about the docks with an old chum who was looking after the fitting out of a new ship. I am always eager, when allowed, to call on a new ship. They interest me like charming young persons. I got mixed up in that crowd seething with an animosity as senseless as things of the street always are, and it was while I was laboriously making my way out of it that the pressman of whom I spoke was jostled against me. He did me the justice to be surprised. "Hat? You here? The last person in the world. If I had known I could have got you inside. Plenty of room. Interest's been over for the last 3 days. Got 7 years. Well, I am glad." "Why are you glad?" "Because he's got 7 years?" I asked, greatly incommoded by the pressure of a hulking fellow who was remarking to some of his equally oppressive friends that the egger ought to have been polyaxed. I don't know whether he had ever confided his savings to DeBarrel, but if so, judging from his appearance, they must have been the proceeds of some successful burglary. The pressman by my side said no, apostrophe to my question. He was glad, because it was all over. He had suffered greatly from the heat and the bad air of the court. The clammy, raw chill of the streets seemed to affect his liver instantly. He became contemptuous and irritable, and plied his elbows viciously, making way for himself and me. A dull affair this. All such cases were dull. No really dramatic moments. The bookkeeping of the orb, and all the rest of them was certainly a burlesque revelation, but the public did not care for revelations of that kind. "Dull dog that DeBarrel," he grumbled. He could not, or would not take the trouble, to characterize for me the appearance of that man, now officially a criminal we had gone across the road for a drink, but told me with a sourly, derisive snigger that, after the sentence had been pronounced, the fellow clung to the dock long enough to make a sort of protest. "You haven't given me time. If I had been given time, I would have ended by being made appear like some of them." Apostrophe, apostrophe, and he had permitted himself his very first and last gesture in all these days, raising a hard clenched fist above his head. The pressman disapproved of that manifestation. It was not his business to understand it. Is it ever the business of any pressman to understand anything? I guess not. It would lead him too far away from the actualities which are the daily bread of the public mind. He probably thought the display worth very little from a picturesque point of view. The weak voice, the colorless personality as incapable of an attitude as a bedpost, the very fatuity of the clenched hand so ineffectual at that time and place, no, it wasn't worth much. And then, for him, an accomplished craftsman in his trade, thinking was distinctly ad business. His business was to write a readable account. But I, who had nothing to write, I permitted myself to use my mind as we sat before our still untouched glasses. And the disclosure which so often rewards a moment of detachment from mere visual impressions, gave me a thrill very much approaching a shudder. I seemed to understand that, with the shock of the agonies and perplexities of his trial, the imagination of that man, whose moods, notions, and motives wore frequently an air of grotesque mystery, that his imagination had been at last roused into activity. And this was awful. Just try to enter into the feelings of a man whose imagination wakes up at the very moment he is about to enter the tomb. Dot, you must not think, went on Marlowe after a pause, that on that morning with Fine I went consciously in my mind over all this, let us call it information. No, better say, this fund of knowledge which I had, or rather which existed, in me in regard to the barrel. Information is something one goes out to seek, and puts away when found as you might do a piece of lead. Ponderous, useful, unvibrating, dull. Whereas knowledge comes to one, this sort of knowledge, a chance acquisition preserving in its repose a fine resonant quality. But as such distinctions touch upon the transcendental I shall spare you the pain of listening to them. There are limits to my cruelty. No. I didn't reckon up carefully in my mind all this, I have been telling you. How could I have done so, with Fine right there in the room? He sat perfectly still, statuesque in homely fashion, after having delivered himself of his effective assent. S. The convict, and I, far from indulging in a reminiscent excursion into the past, remained sufficiently in the present, to muse in a vague, absent-minded way on the respectable proportions, and upon the whole, comely shape of his great pedestrian's calves, for he had thrown one leg over his knee, carelessly, to conceal the trouble of his mind by an air of ease. But all the same the knowledge was in me, the awakened resonance of which I spoke just now. I was aware of it on that beautiful day, so fresh, so warm and friendly, so accomplished and exquisite courtesy of the much abused English climate, when it makes up its meteorological mind, to behave like a perfect gentleman. Of course the English climate is never a rough. It suffers from spleen somewhat frequently, but that is gentlemanly too, and I don't mind going to meet him in that mood. He has his days of gray, veiled, polite melancholy, in which he is very fascinating. How seldom he lapses into a blustering manner after all. And then it is mostly in a season when, appropriately enough, one may go out and kill something. But his fine days are the best for stopping at home, to read, to think, to muse, even to dream, in fact to live fully, intensely, and quietly, in the brightness of comprehension, in that receptive glow of the mind, the gift of the clear, luminous and serene weather. That day I had intended to live intensely and quietly, basking in the weather's glory which would have lent enchantment to the most unpromising of intellectual prospects. For a companion I had found a book, not bemused with the cleverness of the day, a fine weather book, simple and sincere like the talk of an unselfish friend. But looking at little Fine seated in the room I understood, that nothing would come of my contemplative aspirations, that in one way or another I should be let in for some form of severe exercise. Walking, it would be, I feared, since, for me, that idea was inseparably associated with the visual impression of Fine. Where, why, how, a rapid striding rush could be brought in helpful relation to the good Fine's present trouble and perplexity I could not imagine, except on the principle that senseless pedestrianism was Fine's panacea for all the ills and evils bodily and spiritual of the universe. It could be of no use for me to say or do anything. It was bound to come. Contemplating his muscular limb encased in a golf stocking, and under the strong impression of the information he had just imparted, I said wondering, rather irrationally. And so DeBarrel had a wife and child. That girl's his daughter. And how? Fine interrupted me by stating again earnestly, as though it were something not easy to believe, that his wife and himself had tried to befriend the girl in every way, indeed they had. I did not doubt him for a moment, of course, but my wonder at this was more rational. At that hour of the morning, you mustn't forget, I knew nothing as yet of Mrs. Fine's contact. It was hardly more, with DeBarrel's wife and child during their exile at the Priory, in the culminating days of that man's fame. Fine, who had come over, it was clear, solely to talk to me on that subject, gave me the first hint of this initial, merely out-of-doors, connection. He girl was quite a child then, he continued. Later on, she was removed out of Mrs. Fine's reach in charge of a governess, a very unsatisfactory person, he explained. His wife had then H'M met him, and on her marriage she lost sight of the child completely. But after the birth of Polly, Polly was the third Fine girl. She did not get on very well, and went to Brighton for some months to recover her strength, and there, one day in the street, the child she wore her hair down her back still recognized her outside a shop and rushed, actually rushed, into Mrs. Fine's arms. Rather touching this. And so, disregarding the cold impertinence of that. Governess, his wife naturally responded. He was solemnly fragmentary. I broke in with the observation that it must have been before the crash. Fine nodded with deepened gravity, stating in his bass tone, just before, and indulged himself with a weighty period of solemn silence. The Barrel, he resumed suddenly, was not coming to Brighton for weekends regularly then. Must have been conscious already of the approaching disaster. Mrs. Fine avoided being drawn into making his acquaintance, and this suited the views of the governess person, very jealous of any outside influence. But in any case it would not have been an easy matter. Extraordinary, stiff-backed, thin figure all in black, the observed of all, while walking hand in hand with the girl, apparently shy, but and here Fine came very near showing something like insight, probably nursing under a diffident manner a considerable amount of secret arrogance. Mrs. Fine pitied Florida Barrel's fate long before the catastrophe. Most unfortunate guidance. Very unsatisfactory surroundings. The girl was known in the streets, was stared at in public places, as if she had been a sort of princess, but she was kept with a very ominous consistency from making any acquaintances, though of course there were many people no doubt who would have been more than willing to make themselves agreeable to Mr. Barrel. But this did not enter into the plans of the governess, an intriguing person hatching a most sinister plot under her severe air of distant, fashionable exclusiveness. Good little Fine's eyes bulged with solemn horror as he revealed to me, in agitated speech, his wife's more than suspicions, at the time, of that, Mrs. What's her name's perfidious conduct. She actually seemed to have Mrs. Fine asserted formed a plot already, to marry eventually her charge to an impecunious relation of her own, a young man with furtive eyes, and something impudent in his manner, whom that woman called her nephew, and whom she was always having down to stay with her. And perhaps not her nephew. No relation at all, Fine admitted with a convulsive effort. This, the most awful part of the suspicions Mrs. Fine used to impart to him piecemeal, when he came down to spend his weekends gravely with her and the children. The Fines, in their good-natured concern for the unlucky child of the man busied in stirring casually so many millions, spent the moments of their weekly reunion in wondering earnestly what could be done to defeat the most wicked of conspiracies, trying to invent some tactful line of conduct in such extraordinary circumstances. I could see them, simple and scrupulous, worrying honestly about that unprotected big girl, while looking at their own little girls playing on the seashore. Fine assured me that his wife's rest was disturbed by the great problem of interference. It was very acute of Mrs. Fine to spot such a deep game, I said, wondering to myself where her acuteness had gone to now, to let her be taken unawares by a game so much simpler, and played to the end under her very nose. But then, at that time, when her nightly rest was disturbed by the dread of the fate preparing for the Barrel's unprotected child, she was not engaged in writing a compendious and ruthless handbook on the theory and practice of life for the use of women with a grievance. She could as yet, before the task of evolving the philosophy of rebellious action had affected her intuitive sharpness, perceive things which were, I suspect, moderately plain. For I am inclined to believe that the woman whom chance had put in command of Florida Barrel's destiny took no very subtle pains to conceal her game. She was conscious of being a complete master of the situation, having once for all established her ascendancy over the barrel, as he had taken all her measures against outside observation of her conduct, and I could not help smiling at the thought what a ghastly nuisance the serious, innocent Fiennes must have been to her. How exasperated she must have been by that couple falling into Brighton as completely unforeseen as a bolt from the blue, if not so prompt. How she must have hated them. But I conclude she would have carried out whatever plan she might have formed. I can imagine the Barrel accustomed for years to defer to her wishes, and, either through arrogance, or shyness, or simply because of his unimaginative stupidity, remaining outside the social pale, knowing no one but some card-playing cronies, I can picture him to myself terrified at the prospect of having the care of a marriageable girl thrust on his hands, forcing on him a complete change of habits, and the necessity of another kind of existence which he would not even have known how to begin. It is evident to me that Mrs. What's-her-name would have had her atrocious way with very little trouble, even if the excellent Fiennes had been able to do something. She would simply have bullied the Barrel in a lofty style. There's nothing more subservient than an arrogant man, when his arrogance has once been broken in some particular instance. However, there was no time, and no necessity for anyone to do anything. The situation itself vanished in the financial crash as a building vanishes in an earthquake here one moment, and gone the next with only an ill-omened, slight, preliminary rumble. Well, to say in a moment is an exaggeration perhaps, but that everything was over in just 24 hours is an exact statement. Fiennes was able to tell me all about it, and the phrase that would depict the nature of the change best is an instant and complete destitution. I don't understand these matters very well, but from Fiennes' narrative it seemed as if the creditors or the depositors, or the competent authorities, had got hold in the twinkling of an eye of everything the Barrel possessed in the world, down to his watch and chain, the money in his trousers pocket, his spare suits of clothes, and I suppose the cameo pin out of his black satin cravat. Everything. I believe he gave up the very wedding ring of his late wife. The gloomy priory with its damp park, and a couple of farms had been made over to Mrs. de Barrel, but when she died without making a will, it reverted to him, I imagine. They got that, of course, but it was a mere crumb in a Sahara of starvation, a drop in the thirsty ocean. I dare say that not a single soul in the world got the comfort of as much as a recovered threepenny bit out of the estate. Then, less than crumbs, less than drops, there were to be grabbed, the lease of the big Brighton house, the furniture there, the carriage and pair, the girl's riding horse, her costly trinkets, down to the heavily gold-mounted collar of her pedigree Saint Bernard. The dog too went. The most noble-looking item in the beggarly assets. What, however, went first of all, or rather vanished, was nothing in the nature of an asset. It was that plodding governess with the trick of a perfect lady manner severely conventional, and the soul of a remorseless brigand. When a woman takes to any sort of unlawful man trade, there's nothing to beat her in the way of thoroughness. It's true that you will find people who'll tell you that this terrific virulence in breaking through all established things is altogether the fault of men. Such people will ask you with a clever air why the servile wars were always the most fierce, desperate and atrocious of all wars. And you may make such answer as you can, even the eminently feminine one, if you choose, so typical of the women's literal mind, don't see what this has to do with it. How many arguments have been knocked over, I won't say knocked down, by these few words. For if we men try to put the spaciousness of all experiences into our reasoning, and would fain put the infinite itself into our love, it isn't, as some writer has remarked, it isn't women's doing. Oh no. They don't care for these things. That sort of aspiration is not much in their way. And it shall be a funny world, the world of their arranging, where the irrelevant would fantastically step in, to take the place of the sober humdrum imaginative. Dot, I raised my hand, to stop my friend Marlowe. Do you really believe what you have said? I asked, meaning no offense, because with Marlowe one never could be sure. Only on certain days of the year, said Marlowe readily with a malicious smile. Oh day I have been simply trying to be spacious and I perceive I've managed to hurt your susceptibilities which are consecrated to women. When you sit alone and silent you are. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.